Mr. Andrew Carnegie, to the Right Honourable W. E. Gladstone, February the 7th, 1890.
I am travelling homeward from Pittsburgh to New York at rate of 40 miles an hour upon the Pennsylvania Limited. The cars are connected by a covered passageway so that we can pass from end to end of the train. The train has a dining car, its tables beautifully ornamented with flowers, excellent meals provided, fresh cooked on the train, a lady's maid, men's servants, all the latest daily and weekly papers, bathrooms for ladies and gentlemen, a barber shop, an excellent library, special telegrams of public interest are received as we proceed. But the latest addition is the official stenographer to whom I am now dictating. You have received thousands of letters, but none written, I venture to say, under such circumstances.
Well, perhaps a Pullman Palace car doesn't sound so cool in the era of business class air travel. Or an official stenographer in the age of emails and mobile phones. But for its time, 1890, this account of rail travel American style sounded very impressive. And Carnegie, the poor Scots boy turned American steel magnate, enjoyed rubbing in US superiority even to admirers like Gladstone, the grand old man of British politics. Pullman cars were only the icing on the cake. What really mattered in economic terms was that the railroad boom after the Civil War had pulled the United States together into a single market for both people and goods. The merger movement produced a handful of big companies like the Pennsylvania and the New York Central, and imposed a nationwide uniform track gauge of 4 feet, 8.5 inches. Even more striking, the railroads standardized time. In Civil War America, life had run on local time. The town clock was set at noon when the sun passed directly overhead. So there were thousands of different times being observed across America. The idea of standard time zones had been discussed for a while, but it was the railroads who pushed it through under the direction of William Frederick Allen, who had the nightmare job of managing editor of the official railway guide for all of America. After 18 months' study and consultation, he presented to a railroad convention his plan for 4 time zones, roughly straight lines north-south across the country. Allen showed the executives 2 maps, one multicoloured to indicate local times, the other illustrating standard time.
Contrasting the 2 maps, I ask you which system appears more desirable? The one as variegated as Joseph's coat of many colours, or the other with its solid masses of uniform tints? The one representing the barbarism of the past, the other the enlightenment which we hope for the future.
The railroads opted for enlightenment, and so did most cities and towns. Although most Americans welcomed the change, a few critics saw it as evidence of the overweening power of the railroads. The Indianapolis Sentinel complained,
"People, 55 million of them, must eat, sleep, and work as well as travel by railroad time. People will have to marry by railroad time and die by railroad time. We presume the sun, moon, and stars will make an attempt to ignore the orders of the railroad convention, but they, too, will have to give in at last."
The heavens held out, but Americans did not. Standard time eventually became federal law a quarter of a century later in World War I. America's diet was also revolutionized by the railroad age. In the 1860s, most people subsisted on bread, potatoes, root vegetables, meat, usually salted, and dried fruits. Fresh fruit and vegetables were available briefly during the ripening season and after harvest. So the average diet wasn't very nutritious or appetizing, though homemade sauces and relishes added a bit more taste. From the 1870s, however, special freight cars, insulated and packed with ice, enabled meat, fruit and vegetables to be moved from the warm farmlands of the West and South to the North and Midwest. But even more important was what America started eating out of tin cans, thanks mainly to a German-American called Henry John Heinz. A chipper little man with blue eyes and reddish mutton chop whiskers, Heinz grew up, like Andrew Carnegie, in Pittsburgh. His genius was to bring the benefits of the railroad into the American kitchen. Starting out with horseradish pickles and mustard, in 1876, Heinz's Pittsburgh factory branched out into tomato ketchup. H.J. Heinz had a genius for advertising. There was the trademark green pickle pin stamped with the name Heinz, which was handed out to all and sundry. And the famous slogan that echoed around the world. As Heinz told this story, when sitting on a train in Manhattan, he noticed a shoe advert headed 21 Styles.
I said to myself, we do not have styles of products, but we do have varieties of products. Counting up how many we had, I counted well beyond 57. But 57 kept coming back into my mind. Seven. There are so many illustrations of the psychological influence of that figure and of its alluring significance to people of all ages and races that 58 varieties or 59 varieties did not appeal at all to me as equally strong. I got off the train immediately, went down to the lithographer's where I designed a streetcar card and had it distributed throughout the United States. I myself did not realize how highly successful a slogan it was going to be.
Entrepreneurs like Heinz seized on the potential of railroads to create a single market across a country the size of a continent. In Europe, by contrast, there was a plethora of nation-states, each with their own tariffs and standards, and many of these countries would go to war against each other in 1914. So America's single market and its political unity after the Civil War were huge economic bonuses, enabling the country to capitalize on its abundant natural resources, particularly wood, coal, iron, and oil. New technologies were also important in boosting American productivity. In a vast country like the United States, with plenty of cheap land, there were not enough people available to work as wage labor. So this provided considerable incentive to develop labor-saving devices. A Swedish immigrant, Gustav Unonius, marveled at the grain elevators in Chicago.
Six freight cars can be hauled into the elevator for unloading at one time. And so, in 10 minutes, the grain from a train loaded with about 3,000 bushels is raised by 12 elevators, weighed and transferred to the bins. Thus, in less than an hour, two ships are loaded with 12,000 bushels apiece.
By 1900, the United States had leapfrogged over Britain, once known as the workshop of the world, to produce a third of the globe's manufactured goods. What's more, American entrepreneurs were penetrating Britain itself. They were even burrowing into the depths of its capital city. London had pioneered underground railways in 1863. But by the turn of the century, there were only a few lines run by rival companies, and most of them used steam trains. That is, until Charles Tyson Yerkes arrived in town. A shady tycoon from Chicago, he'd built up an empire of tramways and electric railways known as the Chicago Traction Tangle. One of his maxims for success was to
buy up old junk, fix it up a little, and unload it upon other fellas.
Eventually, Yerkes was drummed out of Chicago, so he tried his luck in London. Dame Henrietta Barnett, one of the founders of Hampstead Garden Suburb, noted with concern,
he talks of a proposal to carry all London about in tunnels. The system of underground travelling, he anticipated, would cause the erection of a station on the western edge of Hampstead Heath.
In just 5 years from 1900, Yerkes and his American financial backers consolidated the London Underground into something like a single network. He pushed ahead with electrification, using rolling stock made in America, and he developed three of London's most important lines, what became the Piccadilly, the Northern, and the Bakerloo. The last of these was officially the Baker Street and Waterloo Railway, and the editor of the prestigious railway magazine, Mr. G.A. Noakes, deplored American vulgarisation of its name.
Announcements placed outside the stations that it is the Bakerloo Railway are not likely to increase the popularity of this struggling concern. Its gutter title is not what we expect from a railway company. English railway officers have more dignity than to act in this manner.
Yerkes was just one of many American business predators rampaging through Britain in the first decade of the 20th century. Buck Duke, founder of the American Tobacco Company, was trying to buy up Britain's tobacco industry. Banker J.P. Morgan was bidding for Cunard, the shipping line, while in the high street, H.J. Hines started a factory in Peckham, and the retailer Frank Woolworth opened his first British store in Liverpool. The press whipped up a storm about this American invasion. One journalist predicted the Americanization of the world. Another, Frederick McKenzie of the Daily Mail, warned,
"The average citizen wakes up in the morning at the sound of an American alarm clock, rises from his New England sheets and shaves with his New York soap and a Yankee safety razor. He pulls on a pair of Boston boots and sits down to breakfast, at which he eats bread made from prairie flour and a little Kansas City bacon. Rising, the citizen rushes out, catches an electric tram made in New York to Shepherd's Bush, where he gets into a Yankee elevator, which takes him onto the American-fitted railway into the city."
And so it went on all through the Americanized day. Hyperbole, of course, but this journalistic satire rang painfully true to many in Britain in the 1900s. America had once been Britain's colony. Now, it seemed, the economic roles were reversed. The New World was buying up the old. Another sign of the times was the rash of marriages between financially challenged British aristocrats and the daughters of American plutocrats who were desperate for an old world title. Between 1870 and 1914, no less than one-sixth of the peerage secured American wives. Love may have played a part, but this was essentially a business matter, cash for coronets. Consuelo Vanderbilt, daughter of the railroad tycoon, became Duchess of Marlborough in return for a dowry reputed to be $2.5 million. Miss Jenny Jerome, daughter of a New York financier, came more cheaply at a tenth of the price. But her marriage to the Duke of Marlborough's younger brother proved of far greater significance for Anglo-American relations. They were the parents of Winston Churchill.